This may sound like a strange way to start a message, but people sometimes talk about when a person dies, the last thing they say, and they tell us what those last words were. They can sometimes be significant. Matter of fact, I saw a list once of very famous things people said just before they passed away. That was particularly true, apparently, in ancient times. One author said, the ancients regarded the last words of any person as especially significant. The last words of Israel's great leaders were even more important. The last words of a prophet were extremely important. They often expressed lessons of those who walked with the Lord for many years and what they had learned. End of quote. Now you say, why do you bring that up? It's a strange way to start a message, isn't it? And the answer is, we've been going through the book of 2 Samuel. We've come to the end, and at the end of that book, there is an appendix, and it gives us several little cameos of David's life. And in one of those last chapters of 2 Samuel, it literally tells us the last thing David said. Now, it's inserted because they considered that important. There's a whole chapter about that, and I want us to look at it to see what lessons we can learn from it, what spiritual lessons we can learn. So will you turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 23. 2 Samuel chapter 23. This passage basically falls into two parts. David talks about himself or things related to him in the first part of the passage, and then he talks about men he served with and men who served him. So we're going to start in the first part of this passage where the text tells us, now these are the last words of David. Thus says David, the son of Jesse. Thus says the man raised up on high, the anointed of God of Jacob, and the sweet psalmist of Israel. The Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and his word was on my tongue. Now, this opening verse just sort of gives us some marks of identification of David. It says that he was the son of Jesse, that he was raised on high, that he was anointed by God, and he was the sweet psalmist of Israel. If you analyze those little phrases, you might conclude that he talks about his relationship to his family. He was the son of Jesse. It talks about his political administration, his military experience, and it ends with his spiritual influence. He wrote the Psalms. If you want to understand David and look at his life as a whole, and we're coming to the end of it, you might have to say that he started out as a humble son of Jesse, a Benjaminite. Back in those days, he was a shepherd. He tended sheep on the side of the hill. And eventually, he became the very king of Israel. Today, we might say this is a rags-to-riches story. From a shepherd looking at sheep to a king ministering to people. And yet, the last thing it says in this little list is that he was the sweet psalmist of Israel. He had a spiritual impact on the people because of the Psalms that he wrote, and that is till this day. Now, what does it mean these are the last words of David? That's an interesting way to introduce this chapter, but we need to look at that rather carefully because the first part of verse 1 says, these are the last words of David. And then it says, the Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and his words were on my tongue. Now, that little observation indicates that that these weren't the last words that he said on his deathbed just before he passed away, but this is a more formal kind of last words. We might say something like this is the last sermon he preached or the last address he gave, something of that sort. That it's not the last words on his deathbed and he spoke them and passed away. It's a more formal kind of thing because the Spirit of God moved him to say this, and those words were on his lips. So maybe we could say this is the last inspired utterance that he gave. He clearly is claiming that the Spirit of God moved in this regard. So those opening couple of verses are just giving us who David is. But there's more. Pick it up at verse 3. And the God of Israel said to the rock, the rock of Israel spoke to me, he who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. And he should be like the light of the morning when the sun rises, a morning without clouds, like the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear shining after rain. Now again, we're given descriptive phrases of David, only all of these pertain to his being a ruler. He who rules over men must be just. Now David, as we know, was king. So these undoubtedly refer to him, but at the same time, it's referring to just his position as king over Israel. Now, given the descriptive phrases, I'm going to suggest that David is describing perhaps himself, surely, but more than that, it almost seems like the things that he are saying here would be descriptive of the ideal ruler. David was that in a sense, but seems to me these phrases are describing such a ruler. For example, it says that the ruler must rule over men and he must be just. So what is the one thing you would want out of a ruler but to be just, especially one like a king who made the decisions, something like a judge in our day? So you would want him to be fair. You'd want him to be righteous. You'd want him to be just. But that's a tall order for some. But notice the second phrase, ruling in the fear of God. Maybe we should put those two things together. The ideal ruler would be a God-fearing man. And as a result of his relationship to the Lord, he would rule justly. I think it would be difficult, though not impossible, to be a just ruler without the fear of God. Or to say the same thing another way, it would be more likely that you would be a just ruler if you ruled in the fear of God. You were a God-fearing man. Now, there are two more phrases that describe him, and they're obviously figures of speech. It says he's like light of the morning when the sun rises, morning without clouds. What does that mean? Well, it means it's clear, there are no clouds, it's a bright shining sun in the morning. That he's the kind of ruler then that gives clear direction, clear guidance. There are no clouds. You can see exactly what he is about. And then it says, he's like tender grass springing out of the earth after a rain. So it rains and that encourages the grass to grow. And a good ruler is like that. He's providing for growth. He's providing for prosperity. So these four phrases, it seems to me, are describing the ideal ruler. Now, David was striving to do that. He certainly could be called a God-fearing man. We have illustrations of him making just decisions. And He clearly was a man who had a direction that he communicated to other people. And his kingdom expanded, it provided for growth. So, the ideal ruler is not a dictator doing what he wants. He's an agent of God doing what is just and right and righteous. Now, I say the way this is placed in the passage, it must refer to David. And yet at the same time, it probably refers to David and sets the standard for the rulers that follow after him. But it's interesting that the standard is so high that some of the rabbis in the ancient world said this was really a description of the Messiah. I thought that was interesting and appropriate. As a matter of fact, they're not alone. Some modern interpreters have said that this is ultimately a description of the Messiah. Now, there's more about David. At least the first couple of verses are introducing him. So there's more pertaining to him. Look at verse 5. Although my house is not so with God, yet he has made me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and secure. For this is my salvation and my desire. Will he not make it increase? David viewed his dynasty this way because God made an everlasting covenant with him. And he believed that that covenant will result in an increased blessing on his house, on his dynasty. So I think this verse indicates that what we just saw about what I'm calling the ideal ruler was intended not only for David, but his successors. And David is saying, I'm sure God is going to do this because he made a covenant with me, an everlasting covenant. And that obviously is referring to the Davidic covenant that was made with David back in 2 Samuel chapter 7, where he would be a ruler and so would one of his descendants, and it would ultimately be fulfilled in the Messiah. But then he says in verse 6, but the sons of rebellion shall be as thorns thrust away, because they cannot be taken by hand, but the men who touch them must be armed with iron and the shaft of the spear, and they should be utterly burned with fire in their place. What is he talking about now? Well, talks about the rebellion. Obviously, he says the sons of rebellion. And he is anticipating that there will be judgment on them. Remember, you persecute the Jews, God promised judgment. That's way back in Genesis chapter 12. You bless Abraham, you will be blessed. You curse Abraham, and you will be cursed. So these evil men, and he again uses a figure of speech, are going to be like thorns, and they're going to be tossed into the fire. They're going to be judged by God. Now, these opening seven verses are talking about David and beyond David, describing the ideal king, the ideal ruler. But they're basically describing David. Someone has summed this up by saying David believed that the Lord would bless him and those who followed him would be blessed because of the Abrahamic covenant. Now, I said a minute ago that the passage is divided into two parts. The first part talks about David, and the second part talks about, well, the text calls them mighty men. These are men who served with David or for David. And the rest of the passage is about them. So let's look at what it has to say. For example, verse 8 says, these are the names of the mighty men whom David had. Now that's the introduction to the rest of the chapter. The first man that's mentioned is Bathsheba, who's called chief among the captains because he killed 800 men at one time. So this verse is sort of the topic sentence of the rest of the passage. And it introduces a man who obviously was a member of the armed forces. And he killed 800 men at one time. So he was a very brave warrior. He was captain. So he was a leader among the leaders. He was highly successful in that he slew 800 men. Verse 10 introduces somebody else. After him was Eleazar, one of the three mighty men with David, when they defied the Philistines who had gathered there for battle and the men of Israel had retreated. This is the second mighty man that he mentions. This is Eleazar. When all the rest retreated, Eleazar was one of the three mighty men that helped David defy the Philistines. So obviously he was brave. He stuck around when everybody left. He was loyal to David. Everybody forsook him and he stayed with him. And he was persistent. But now there's an interesting little thing that says in this passage. He arose and attacked the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand stuck to the sword. The Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to plunder. Now, they all deserted David, except this fellow, a couple of others. And they came back when the victory was won, and so they could get the spoils of war. But what intrigues me is that his hand stuck to the sword. One commentator trying to explain this talked about something that happened in 1860 when there was a battle in Mount Lebanon, and a man so clung to his sword that he could not open it until somebody pried his muscles off the sword. When I read all of that, I thought, you know what? I experienced something similar to that once. I grew up in the South. I did not see real snow until I was an adult. And then as I began to travel, I started traveling by car until I learned that it was easier to fly. And one of those trips, I was invited to speak in Minnesota, and I drove. And I got to Minnesota and hit a snowstorm. I think it was the first time I'd ever driven in a snowstorm. I'd learned by that time to drive in snow, but this was intense. And it lasted for hours. And I remember, till this day, gripping the steering wheel and watching every moment because I didn't want to land in the ditch because it was cold out there. And I did that for so long, and apparently I was so uptight that when I got to where I was going, somebody had to help me ply my fingers off the steering wheel. Now, that's what's being described here. He was so intense in gripping that sword and so intense and persistent in battle that they had to peel his hands off the sword. Then it says, after him, in verse 11, there was Shema. This Philistines had gathered together into a troop where they pieced together, they were coming at him on a field of lentils. So the people fled from the Philistines, but he stationed himself in the middle of the field and defended it and killed the Philistines. So the Lord brought him a great victory. This is an interesting story. You did what? You stood and defended a field of lentils? Matter of fact, to make this even more interesting, this story is repeated in 1 Chronicles. And in 1 Chronicles, it says it was a field of barley. Well, which was it, lentils or barley? Boy, you ought to read the commentaries on that one. Well, maybe it was two different fields and he defended both of them. Or maybe there were both crops in the same field, they suggest. At any rate, he defended for David this field of lentils. He was faithful in that defense He was courageous in standing against them. One wrote, "The Lord asked many of his children to work and serve in small, inconspicuous places where no one sees them and no voice praises them. In fact, it may be that he has called you to just such a task. Are you willing to stay by the lintel patch and let others have the limelight?" So in all these men that served David, here's one he picks out and says, "You know this fella? He defended the lintel patch." And he lists him as one of his three great warriors. So there are three warriors that he's mentioned. Someone has suggested that one of them is a spiritual warrior with exceptional strength. He slew 800 men. Another has unusual stamina and persistence. That's the one that gripped the sword. And one had great supernatural steadfastness. At any rate, David spells out by name three warriors that served him, and in essence is commending them for their service. Now, look at verse 13. "Then three of the 30 chief men went down at harvest time and came to David at the cave of Adullam, and the troops of the Philistines encamped in the valley." Now, I want you to notice in this verse that it says three of the 30. When we get to the end of the passage, there's a long list of names. It doesn't mention anything any of them did. It just mentions that these were some of his mighty warriors. What this verse is telling us, three of the 30. So he's singling out 30 who were outstanding, but he's focusing on three within the 30. Now there's a little problem. Are these three the same three that he just mentioned? Now you can only imagine what Bible teachers do with this. There are three different opinions. One says yes, one says no, the other says I don't know. Now, having looked at the passage, I'm of the opinion that he is probably talking about the same three. He's named them. He just doesn't name them again. But these three men were outstanding men among the 30 that were already outstanding. So look at verse 14. "David was then in the stronghold of the garrison, and the Philistines were in Bethlehem. And David said with longing, 'Oh, that someone would give me a drink of water from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate.' So the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines, drew water from the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate, and they took it and brought it to David. Nevertheless, he would not drink it, but poured it out to the Lord." I think this is one of the strangest stories in all of the book of 2 Samuel. Now imagine this. Well, the first thing you got to remember is, where was David born? Bethlehem, remember? Well, now this is years later, and he's hiding away in a cave, and Saul is chasing him. In the meantime, the Philistines have occupied the city of Bethlehem. So David and a few of these men are tucked away in this cave, and David says, "You know, I remember that good tasting water. It was by that well. It came out of that well by the wall in Bethlehem. Boy, I wish I had some of that water." Now that intrigues me. There are some connoisseurs of water. I'm not one of them. Water is water. Can you tell a difference in different? Can you? All of you are voting against me. All right. Well, apparently this was particularly good tasting water. And David simply says, boy, I wish I had some of that water. So three of his men decide they're going to go get the water. But the city of Bethlehem is being occupied by the Philistines. You're going to risk your life for a glass of water. Strange story. Why would they do that? Why would God put that in the Bible? What's the lesson here? What is going on? This story really intrigues me. Would you do that? You know, what is the phrase that, you know, a man falls in love with his girl and says, I'd swim across shark-infested waters for you. You remember that? You know, how many men have done that? But would you risk your life to go get a fella a drink of water out of a well? They did it. Now, that whole story just really fascinates me. Then they managed to do it, and they bring the water back to David, and David pours it out on the ground. I read that story and I thought, this thing gets weirder by the verse. What? Poured it out on the ground? Matter of fact, I called a pastor friend of mine. He and I talk about our sermons all the time. I said, what do you do with that? And he gave me some ideas. And then I went back and read the passage. Notice it carefully. It's in verse 16. Nevertheless, he would not drink it, but poured it out to the Lord. Did you see that? That's the key to this. Matter of fact, look down at verse 17. And he said, far be it from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Is this not the blood of men who went in jeopardy of their lives? Therefore, he would not drink it. These things were done by the three mighty men. So David took that which was precious to him and costly to them, and he gave it to the Lord. When I first read this, my first knee-jerk reaction was, I think I'd have been offended. I just risked my life and you poured it out on the ground? But as I read the passage, I thought, you know what? I think they understood, but basically because of what he said. And this is the point. David took something very valuable and something he wanted, something that was precious to him, and he gave it to the Lord. Now, pouring it out on the ground is, in essence, a drink offering. That one of the offerings they gave in the Old Testament was that kind of an offering. Matter of fact, you're aware that in the Old Testament they did sacrifices, right? I think most people think, well, the only time you did a sacrifice is if you sinned, you went and did an animal sacrifice. That's not true. If you read the sacrifices in Leviticus, they were memorials and they were offerings. The book of Hebrews says that we do that when we offer the Lord praise. That's a sacrifice. That's an offering. We don't do the animal. We do praise. And in Hebrews chapter 13, it talks about a praise of good works. So, do you ever just do something for the Lord because you're serving Him? And I thought about all the people that work. I thought about naming them, and I thought, I don't dare do that. I'll leave some out. But just all the people in this church who do little things we never notice. I know people that do things behind the scene, and you never see them. And they're just very faithful at doing it. And they're doing these little things as unto the Lord. So they are giving themselves. They're giving their time. They're giving their effort to the Lord. And so that's in essence what David was doing. He was so overwhelmed by what they did that he took this thing that was very precious to them and him, and he said, I'm going to give it to the Lord. So these were three mighty men who showed sacrifice, dedication, and loyalty. And David gave it to the Lord. Someone commenting on this passage said, "All people are created equal before God and the law. But all people are not equal in gifts and abilities. Some people have greater gifts and opportunities than others. However, the fact that we can't achieve like the first three shouldn't keep us from doing less than our best. God doesn't measure us by what he helped others do, but by our own abilities." Now, I read that because you don't have to go risk your life for a drink of water. You just need to do what the Lord has given you the ability to do. Now, there's more. Look at verse 18. There are two other outstanding men. He says, now, Bibishai, the brother of Joab, that's interesting, was chief of another three. Now notice the word "another" is in italics. That's not in the Hebrew text, but he's going to talk about some others that warranted. "He lifted up his spear against 300 men, killed them, and won a name among these three. Was he not the most honored of the three? Therefore he became their captain. However, he did not obtain to the first three." What an interesting statement. "Because of what he did, he became captain of three. But he did not obtain to the position of the first three." Chief among them, he was famous among them, but he didn't make it to the first three. What do you do with that? You know, Jesus had different groups. He spoke to the multitude, had a wide ministry, speaking to thousands. Matter of fact, at one point he fed 5,000, not counting the women and children. That's a huge crowd. And then he had 70. He sent them out. They were a special group within the big group. And then there were 12. They are the ones that traveled with him. That would have been a privilege. And then there were three. And then there were three. Now, what I think this text is saying is David had groups like that. And there were three. There were three. Now, there were some others outstanding. And one of them in particular, he didn't make it to the top three, but he made it and he was big. Get the picture? Let me make a suggestion. My mentor said to me once, regardless of how big a ministry the Lord gives you, you are only going to really have a greatest impact on seven people. What? Now, the Lord has given me some great opportunities to speak to very large crowds. But you know what? He's right. He's right. But as I look back over my life, there are really a handful of people I've had the greatest impact on. They're the ones I spent time with. It's not just the sermon I preached, but it was the time I spent with them. So I've learned that's the way to have the greatest impact on people. And the same thing is true of you. You need to have impact on people, but you're only going to have the greatest impact on a few. But do it. Perhaps those should be your family members or your friends. But just know there are the three. And then there's another group of three that didn't make it to the first group, but they were still outstanding. So that's what David is saying. As I look back over my life, there were three people that really were the top notch. And then there was another group of three. There were some others. They didn't make it to the first, but they were still very outstanding. Lesson: be all you can be.
and let the Lord determine which group you're in. There's another man, Benani. His story still is told beginning in verse 20. And it says, he killed two lion-like heroes of Moab. He also had gone down and killed a lion in the midst of a pit in a snowy day. He killed an Egyptian. The Egyptian had a spear in his hand, so he went down to him with a shaft, wrestled a spear out of the Egyptian's hand, killed him with his own spear. These things he did, and he won the name among the three mighty men. He was more honored than the 30, but he did not obtain to the first three, and David appointed him over his guard. All right, here's another fella. By the way, he apparently was a priest. We know that because of his lineage. And he's the only priest who became a soldier, as far as we know, in the scripture. He became the head of David's guard. We would say today he was the head of the bodyguards, a position that David had occupied when he was serving Saul. So, here's another person that, well, he was outstanding. Look at all the things he did. And he gets credit for it. And he didn't make it to the top three. But he was still outstanding. Now, one more part of this passage. I mentioned it earlier. Beginning in verse 24 and going all the way down through verse 39, he mentions the 30. And the whole point of this passage is, the latter part of it, is David had 30 people that were outstanding. There were three that he really put at the top of the list. There were three others, but there were 30 total. Now, what is the point of this passage? I said, began by saying, these were David's last words. Those are significant. Well, what is the significant? Well, I wrestle with this passage trying to figure that out. One point I thought David's last words were about what God had done through him and what others had done for him and with him. And very little is said about David. Matter of fact, David doesn't talk about his accomplishments like he talks about the accomplishments of other people. He could have. He could have put in here, he slew the giant, Goliath. Doesn't do that. So it talks about him as being a just ruler, doing things rulers ought to do. But it doesn't pat himself on the back, so to speak. Rather, it highlights what others have done. And by the way, if you're familiar with the life of David, you can't help but notice he left out Joab. Joab was general of his army. And Joab doesn't get mentioned. Maybe that's because he's the one who killed Absalom, David's son. So as I looked at this passage, I thought, wow, what an outstanding lesson here. And the more I thought about it, I concluded this. David feared God. Could we say that? David feared God. He ruled justly. Could we say that? And he provided for his people. That's the first part of the passage. And the last part of the passage is telling us what? What all these other people did. How do you put those two things together? Now bear with me for a minute. I'm going to probe this passage, all right? I want us to look at the details of this passage. There are a number of different ways to look at it. I learned that as doing marriage counseling. I heard his side. Then I heard her side. And wait a minute, is this the same couple? I decided a long time ago there are three positions. His, hers, and the truth. That wasn't fair. I'm simply trying to illustrate that There are different ways to look at a story, right? So let me walk through this passage. This is clearly one thing he does is talk about being a leader. Now, what does it take to be a leader? Let's just probe that part of the passage. I remember years ago, I remember the first time somebody said this to me, who do people vote for president? And somebody said to me, they vote for the person who is likable. I heard that many years ago. You know what? I hear that today. They'll say, this candidate is not likable. Is that who we choose as a leader? Somebody that's likable? A few years later, I heard somebody say, in their opinion, the current president was a poor speaker. And they said, the next president will be a good speaker. Is that what you choose? Well, let me tell you what this passage says. A God-fearing individual who does justice and provides for his people. So maybe we could draw that out of this passage. And that's here. No question about that. This passage focuses on an ideal leader, as I'm calling it. Another way to look at this passage is the men who served with or for David. They were described as being highly successful, verse 8. Brave, loyal, and persistent, verses 9 and 10. Faithful, courageous, verses 11 and 12. Intensely loyal and brave, verses 14 to 16. Bravery and loyalty are both mentioned twice in this passage. So these are men with all these characteristics who served David. They were serving the Lord, granted, but they were expressing that by serving David. That's a lesson here. The first part of the passage deals with the ideal leader. And the second part of the passage deals with people who served that leader. Fair enough? Jesus said in Mark chapter 10, verse 44, verse 45, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for many. You want to be Christ-like? Be a servant. And that means you serve people. You serve the Lord by serving people. The greatest are those who are servants. Now, that's one way to look at the passage. You can look at David. You can look at these people who served David. Another way of looking at this passage is David is looking back over his life. But he doesn't talk about his accomplishments. He doesn't even talk about himself. He talks about other people who sacrificially served him and how they were loyal, how they were persistent. But the thing that blows my mind more than anything else is those men went and got him a drink of water. Whoa! How do you explain that? Is that unusual or what? Would you say that's unusual? I would. So let me suggest one way to put this passage together. And it is this. David feared the Lord. David ruled justly. David provided for his people. And the people were intensely loyal to him because of who he was. Would you do that for somebody? They would have to be pretty special, right? I think putting both of the parts of this passage together, we have to conclude that they were so loyal to David because they knew David, and they knew him intimately. They knew what his favorite drink of water was. And they so respected him that they were willing to risk their lives to get him that drink of water. So, this passage starts out talking about the ideal ruler. It says, the Lord brought about a great victory, verse 12. He poured out the water as unto the Lord, verse 16. And far it be it from me that I should do this. And he spoke that to the Lord, verse 17. Ah, we can look at this passage and see David. We can look at this passage and see those who were loyal to him. And we can look at this passage and see the Lord. Maybe that's the key to the whole passage. That David was a God-fearing man. And these people were loyal to David because he took that drink of water and poured it out on the ground. And what they saw is there is a godly man. There is a man who puts the Lord first. There is a man who's going to give his best to the Lord. And they couldn't help respect that and be loyal to him because of that. So put these things together. The men in this passage were devoted to David, but it was the Lord who gave them the victory. These people were loyal to David because David was loyal to the Lord. So the bottom line of this passage is the Lord was involved in this. Now, how would you like to have some people do for you what these three men did for David? Would you like that kind of loyalty? Then be like David. Be a God-fearing person. Put the Lord first. You serve him, and they who serve you will respect you for that. That, I think, is what's going on in this passage. But you can't leave the Lord out of it. It was the key to David's life was the Lord. The key to their victory was the Lord. This passage makes that explicitly clear. So the bottom line is it's the Lord. The Apostle Paul wrote, "But by the grace of God, I am what I am. And his grace toward me was not in vain, but I labored more abundantly than they all, yet not I, but the grace of God that was with me." Ah, that puts it together. You go do all you can do. Whatsoever your hand findeth to do, do it with all your might, and do it as unto the Lord. And when you do, the Lord will honor you, and so will people. Let's pray. Father, thank you for these examples of men who were committed to you and men who were committed to others because of you. Lord, give us that kind of grace, that we be those kind of people that serve others because we want to serve you. And because others serve you as well. In Jesus' name, amen.